take me back to the mountains where the sun never set. I know I'll be back to the city. I'll be back where the river runs through. Once you see, you never will leave. The smell of the north catching on like a cold.
Right. Oh, hello, everybody. Welcome to By the Lyric. My name is Lisa, and this is the show where we take songs and we look at their lyrics and kind of try and decipher what the meaning was and what the artist was trying to tell us. So, in honor of Mother doing their Dance and Cry tour, which is their latest released album, I've actually wanted to do a Mother song for a while, but I found that a lot of them are very emotional and not so much, about specific events. But this song, No Culture, really hit close to home, and it's one of my number one songs by Mother. I'm a huge fan. excuse me. So, this is going to be a pretty opinionated piece as compared to some of the other episodes that we've done. So, let me start off by kind of prefacing the song, and the album is actually called No Culture as well. It's their second most latest release. Their latest release actually came out, I think, maybe 2 months ago, a month ago, January, February, I don't remember, a few months ago. And that was Dance and Cry. So No Culture came out maybe about a year ago. So Mother is a Canadian indie rock group who released their sixth album, No Culture, on a day. While the title suggests that Mother defies any specific label, this album shows the group returning to more acoustic and pop roots of previous albums like The Styx and Eureka. The tracks on No Culture sound a bit more produced than some of their older songs, but across the 10 tracks, it is clear that the group hasn't lost the playful energies and percussive power that have characterized their sound in the past. So here is a little interview excerpt that describes a little bit more about No Culture. So The Drugs is a single off of No Culture, and the video for The Drugs uses a really stylized black and white look. How did the concept come about? That was born out of the album aesthetic and the album cover, which meant to symbolize a state of beginning or blankness being tainted by external influences. So that sort of gave birth to the theme of black and white, with much of the record being about the concept of identity and it being something that is formed over time and as a byproduct of things that have happened to you, not so much because of your essence. Because when I first saw the album cover, I thought about how society sort of imprints on us as individuals, like once we are born, right? Yeah, that's the idea. With the album title, does that entwine how culture negatively influences us sometimes? Yeah, it is using the word culture in a projective sense. It's suggesting that we get away from ourselves as time goes on and we lose touch with our own humanity and nature. And the perception is to strip away and remove your cultural influences as a means to return. Another article writes, one of the catchiest songs on No Culture, the sixth album from Vancouver-based five-piece Mother Mother, is a declarative song sing-along Back to School. So this is about the song Back to School. At face value, the pop rock stomper channels the same schoolyard disobedience of Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall Part 2 and Alice Cooper's School's Out. But if you dig a little deeper, there is some soul searching going on that's closer to something like Smashing Pumpkins' Bullet with Butterfly Wings than it is a snide shot at the education system. Ryan Gildemond, Mother Mother's vocalist and guitarist, and a founding member, along with his sister Molly Gildemond, says that the song was about going to a different kind of school. That song is about going about back to the school of self, which is what I was going through when I wrote it, says Ryan, accompanied by Molly, at a West End Toronto coffee shop 2 weeks before No Culture's February 2017 release. And this idea of being in the classroom of your own soul, not getting it, not getting the lesson, looking up at the chalkboard and all the letters are scrambled because your brains don't work anymore. It takes that confused schoolyard angst and attaches it to an adult identity crisis. This self-questioning idea of identity crisis is a central theme that runs throughout No Culture. It's been 3 years since Mother Mother released their last album, Very Good Bad Thing, and the time between records was a period of deep reflection for Ryan. The album centers around the theme of identity, specifically authenticity versus facade, says Ryan, and we use the term culture in a pejorative sense, suggesting that it's an adopted thing that detracts you from your true essence. So the description is to strip yourself of your culture, your influences that have led you astray from who you actually are. That came to me in the grip of an identity crisis of my own. You wouldn't think Mother Mother would be the sort of act to suffer from a crisis of faith. This is, after all, a band that has an armful of Juno and Much Music Video Award nominations and an impressive mastery of modern rock radio. They've hit the Canadian alternative radio charts with more than 12 separate singles, including The Stand, 2011, Let's Fall in Love, which hit number 3 in 2012. On top of that, the particularly striking band, which also includes Jasmine Parker, Ali Saidat, and Mike Young, have attracted more than 1.3 million views of their music videos on YouTube. For all the talk of identity crisis and self-examination that Mother Mother went through in the making of No Culture, the response they're hoping to receive from listeners is a simple one. It would be nice if they could let the music wash over them and have a visceral, physical reaction, to dance, to move, to feel something inexplicably, without feeling the pressure to define it, says Ryan, but also having a portal to dissect and in turn flex an intellectual and interpersonal muscle. We want to provide these two experiences, something that's animal and primal and something that's heady. But that physical response we want to come first. As with any good song, it should get people moving. So here is our first listen of No Culture by Mother Mother. All right, welcome back. So again, that was Mother Mother's No Culture. And while Ryan said that the main theme of the album, No Culture, was to strip away that culture to find your true essence, I believe that this song is a little bit on the flip of that. Let's get into it before, like, without me trying to explain ahead of time. So let's get into the lyrics. The first intro is, hey, all right, hey, all right. And then the first verse is, I am a vulture, I fly, I make a circle above your culture, I got no culture of mine. So Vultures are carnivorous and eat the decaying flesh of dead animals almost exclusively. They prefer fresh meat but can consume carcasses that may have rotted so much that the meat can be toxic to other animals. While vultures eat mostly dead animals, they are capable of attacking and will often prey on extremely sick, wounded, or infirm prey. This is more common if food has been scarce and there are no carcasses nearby. Vultures, funnily enough, do not actually circle above their prey waiting for it to die before descending for their meal. The reason for the circling is actually that they catch a wave of thermal air that allows them to coast in circles without using energy and simply observe their surroundings, evaluating their best next step. So while circling may not be a patient wait to attack, it sure does make for some vivid imagery, making the meaning of the song that much stronger. In this metaphor, we see that the narrator is the vulture who was waiting to feast on its prey, the culture that he has targeted. It is meant here that the predator made a calculated decision to prey on culture and that it is not some random attack. The supposed violence was well thought out and premeditated. The next verse goes, I am piranha, I bite, I make a supper out of your culture, I got no culture. Piranha is the common name for various South American freshwater tropical fish of the order Charciformes, known for their pointed, razor-sharp teeth and a pronounced underbite and an aggressive appetite for meat and flesh. While piranhas tend to be voraciously feeding schoolfish, their reputation as a threat to human beings or their livestock generally is largely overstated. Local children swim in South American rivers inhabited by piranha. For most people, the greatest danger from their teeth is when trying to remove one from a fishing hook. Nonetheless, the unique form and behavior of piranhas add to the wonder of nature for people, and again adds vivid imagery to the metaphor and message that Mother Mother is trying to send to us. Again, the making a supper out of suggests that the described attack is premeditated, and the act of violence is calculated and intentional. These first two verses bring us to the conclusion that someone has a grudge against culture because they've never had the opportunity to experience one of their own. Personally, I see this in my everyday life. Growing up with a strong tie to my own Ukrainian heritage and being an immigrant myself, and living in a community that breathes its culture has shaped the person that I am. I see two kinds of people here during my daily life in Canada. People who grew up with the culture, religion, traditions of a different country, and those who grew up without. I'll call these people simple members of society from the cultural perspective. The only nation they identify with is Canada or the US. What I mean by this is they grew up in the Canadian-American identity. Their extracurriculars were not tied to any other culture in particular. Any traditions they practiced are limited to their direct family members, what some people may refer to as whitewashed. When I talk to such simple members of society, they have a difficult time understanding how I live my life, and I have a hard time understanding how they live theirs. In my eyes, their lives are lacking substance and depth, but in a way that they don't even understand what they are missing out on because they were raised without it. The richness that comes with culture, especially culture of countries that are hundreds of centuries old, is something that I believe every person should experience in order to fully understand what other people are tied to and just to fully experience being human. Let's listen to some more of No Culture's album. So because I am going to go see Mother Mother today in their Dance and Cry tour, I thought we could just have this as a Mother Mother focused show. So we've got through the first two verses of No Culture, and I'd like to start off with the first song on the album called Free, and then we'll go from there. All right, welcome back. So again, that was Free and Love Stuck from Mother Mother's No Culture album. So we've gone through the first two verses, which was kind of taking animals like vultures and piranhas and depicting the narrator as intently attacking culture as its prey. So we're getting into the pre-chorus now, and the pre-chorus goes, and I'm like a kid in a candy store taking all the toffee that I don't ask for. A state of utter fascination with many good or tempting things all around you can be described in the line, "I'm like a kid in a candy store." The addition of the taking line is referencing how white Westerners take pieces of things from other cultures without being respectful or courteous of the significance of those things. Yoga is a classic example. In one article, a teacher describes how she was introducing yoga to her class, and she mentioned that it came from India, to which a girl of Indian descent in the classroom, she was adopted by American parents, didn't actually know that yoga came from India. Here's an excerpt from that article. "There is a profound inner expansion in the body, heart, and imagination that occurs in a child's sense of what is possible when she connects with the very real and important contributions that have been added to the world's wonders by the likes of herself and her ancestors. I saw it in my student's face that day, and I observe it in the way she now grabs a mat up front and center for every yoga class, always eager, smiling, and fully engaged in every lesson. How many children and humans in general have been robbed of this kind of enthusiastic connection to a world around them because we only tell a single story, that whiteness is supreme and that white people are responsible for everything noteworthy or great? Were you to Google yoga right now, the image results are absurd when you note that the word yoga actually means union. You would likely see images of skinny white women in contorted physical shapes, dressed in nothing but a bathing suit, expensive athleisure clothing, or in some cases, nude. The mechanism that drives this perception of yoga affects every perception we have. Evidently, even the most sourced and trustworthy internet search engines of the world are biased in favor of whiteness and everything white. Wondering why there are no great stock photos of an Indian girl in a Western school classroom doing yoga in this blog post? When I Google yoga or even kids yoga, it practically is impossible to see any children, adolescents, or adult students or teachers of color without changing the keywords to black yogis or Latino yoga, despite the fact that there are plenty who exist. Dreadlocks and braids are another example. Here's a clip of a white man speaking about an incident at a San Francisco university where a woman of color tried to confront him for having dreadlocks.
I looked at her and she said, "Sorry, we don't want people with your hair here." And I was like, "Wow, that's really rude." And I walked away from the situation. She then apparently followed me down two flights of stairs to approach me about this whole situation. And I tried to leave multiple times and she wouldn't let me. She kept grabbing me, pushing me back, trying to make her point or something. I didn't want to talk or discuss the situation with her at all. I felt that I didn't need to explain myself, my hair, my rules, my body. Someone within an activist group thought that she could attack me based on it, based on my locks, and that's not okay. It's not even part of the like colored community's culture. Like, it may be with ingrained in it, but it's ingrained in so many cultures other than that. It's an Egyptian culture, it's in Viking culture. You'll see in like Victorian culture that there is information about them having dreadlocks too. Like, it's everywhere. It's not something that is just part of the colored community. When people wear Native American headdresses, I feel like that is cultural appropriation, because that is something that solely is within their culture that they use for power movement. Only people of high standing within that community can have headdresses. And that would be cultural appropriation. But someone having locks, which is found universally across the world, not just within African culture, but everywhere actually, that is not cultural appropriation in my view. The fact that I have locks does not mean that I'm trying to appropriate anyone's culture. It means that I love and respect their culture, and it's something that I hold true to myself. I feel like these differences are not something that separate us, but are something that should bring us closer together. Hair tangles naturally. It is something that naturally will happen.
Does that happen naturally to your hair?
No. I'm not saying that it did, but at the same time, it's something that I wanted it to happen. Like, it does naturally happen to other people. Their hair will naturally dread. So those people that naturally dreads, is it okay that they have it? Dreadlocks are tied to cultures, but at the same time, there's also instances of dreadlocks not being tied to cultures.
It is. What cases?
Well, she just mentioned the Irish, but it's also, like, I'm sure that anyone that has had tangled hair in the past that didn't have access to combs probably had dreadlocks. Cavemen, I bet you had dreadlocks.
When you're coming from a place of privilege and you're taking an element of somebody's culture that symbolizes
symbolizing anything for her. I bet you if you asked her directly what dreadlocks mean, she would not fully know.
Why do you say that?
Huh?
Why do you say that?
Because it's something that a lot of people don't know. There's a lot of research. It's something that, like, it's not something that is common within African American culture. Like, it's not something that all across the board you will see that they believe in, that they cherish, that they, like, it's something that they wear in their head. Like, it's something that is their hairstyle. Like,
do you see it as a fashion statement and a hairstyle more so than a cultural icon?
I feel like it has both. I don't feel like it's one or the other. I feel like it has both. It can have some cultural ties, but it can also have, like, style ties. Just like a bindi, you know?
So, while it may be difficult to attribute dreadlocks to one single country or one single culture, I believe that it is extremely important to bear in mind that the actual term dreadlock comes from the Rastafarian culture, which is widely credited with popularizing the look in Western culture. Rastafarians consider the locks a sign of their African identity and a religious vow of their separation from what they call Babylon, a historically white European imperialist structure that has oppressed blacks and other people of color since way back when, according to Migrations and History. Cultural appropriation is about the power dynamic. When people with power and privilege decide to validate customs and traditions that oppressed people have been long marginalized for by saying, "This is the hot new thing," then we have serious problems. Or when they refuse to credit the people who innovated those styles or traditions, but claim them as original ideas, then we get into appropriation, said an expert PhD on cultural subjects. She also said, showing love for something awesome and doing so with respect to the culture is appreciation, and I don't see problems with that for the most part. I do think white people have to be mindful of their privilege, though, and think twice before hopping on the newest trend, especially if it clearly borrows from disenfranchised people. You see, there is a fine line between appropriation and appreciation, and this man clearly believes that he is appreciating while others believe he is appropriating. To me, it's like there is this is exactly where the danger of whitewashing comes in. He doesn't have a culture of his own, and so he is craving and searching for more depth to associate his identity with. This is why people need culture and why we have cases such as this, or even more severe ones such as the Rachel Dolezal case. For those that need a refresher, Rachel Dolezal led a secret life in the Pacific Northwest. Her friends believed that she was a black woman with a passion for African American issues. Others saw her as a vocal civil rights leader who later became the local NAACP president in Spokane Wash. She was also a liar, however, her parents said. Estranged from their daughter, her parents came forward in June of 2015 to out her as a white woman who had carried on a giant ruse, exposing her in what quickly morphed from a local story into an international sensation. 2 months later, the authorities claimed in court documents this week she started another scheme. From August until last November of 2015, Ms. Dolezal received nearly $8,850 in public assistance from Washington State after she had falsely claimed she had little income and needed financial help, according to court documents. Prosecutors ended up charging Ms. Dolezal, who legally changed her name in 2016 to Nkechi Amare Diallo, with theft by welfare fraud, perjury, and falsifying records for public assistance, all felonies. During the more than 2 years she received public aid, Ms. Dolezal reported a single source of income, $300 per month in gifts from friends. But investigators with the state's Department of Social and Health Services found that she had deposited nearly $84,000 into her bank account during the same period, according to court documents. So was she pretending to be black in order to get welfare? Was she pretending to be black because she wanted more culture to identify herself with? It's a topic that has been debated widely since this case came to light. Yet another example is the current massive spike in fashion using embroidery on clothing. While for me and many other Ukrainians who see embroidery as a staple of Ukrainian culture and something that is almost sacred, you know, traditional dress, the trends make it more accessible, and we were able and are able to incorporate symbolism that is truly special to us and a part of who we are into our everyday wardrobe and expression of identity. I read how exploitative this industry truly was in other cases. While personally I can tell the difference between European embroidery and, say, South American embroidery, not everyone can, and those who are uneducated but trying to tie themselves to something can come across as offensive. I read from an article released in April of 2016 that Lady Justice tipped her scales against the cultural appropriation practices of big fashion. In the potentially landmark case of Navajo Nation versus Urban Outfitters, a federal judge in New Mexico has ruled against the corporate distributor of Navajo-themed underwear. The corporation claimed that the Navajo Nation knowingly delayed legal action in order to persecute the company. In turn, the Navajo Nation has argued that Urban Outfitters' misuse of the Navajo name is trademark infringement and a violation of the U.S. Indian Arts and Crafts Act of 1990. As a result of the ruling, the Navajo Nation is now one step closer to a multi-million dollar payout and a watershed moment for the indigenous intellectual property movement. Urban Outfitters isn't the first or likely the last to participate in such practices, which are reliant on privilege, racial, economic, cultural, or other, and dependent on a lack of legal agency amongst indigenous people and groups. Rather, the fashion industry, from haute couture to Kmart, has an obsessive penchant for cultural plagiarism and exploitation. Until now, these practices have remained largely unchecked. While there has been a push towards the adoption of ethical fashion practices, designers need only give a lukewarm apology or explanation to be forgiven. Cases of blatant racism and aesthetic piracy are written off as mere faux pas and forgotten by the next fashion season. However, indigenous groups like the Navajo Nation are now establishing a new model for combating corporate exploitation by claiming intellectual property rights and trademarking traditional designs. The Navajo Nation is but among several indigenous communities around the world pursuing legal avenues to protect their identities and material culture. Other examples given in the articles were exploitation of cultural dress from East Africa, Mexico, indigenous people of North America, and even Nunavut. I even personally have a story about intellectual cultural theft. The first weekend of February, I participated in a Ukrainian volleyball tournament, and what usually happens is during the tournament, they will play music. The last time that I participated in the tournament, they played a lot of Ukrainian kind of dance music, which was just coming out of Ukraine, and it was new, and everyone who's kind of knows already all the Ukrainian songs had something new to listen to and something new to look forward to. This year, however, the organizing group decided to take on a DJ that had no ties to Ukrainian culture, so he was, I think, Greek and just Canadian, something like that. And so he was just playing regular, you know, top 40 hits. However, I approached him and I said, hey, this is a Ukrainian tournament. We're used to listening to Ukrainian music. I have a great playlist if you'd like to play that instead. So I pulled up my playlist, and for the rest of the day, that is what we listened to. At the end of the day, I came up to the DJ and I said, what did you think about that? Sounds pretty cool. You know, there's some good beats in here. And he said, yeah, I really like some of the songs. I'm thinking about stealing them. And immediately, I was like, excuse me, sorry, no, I didn't show it to you so that you could steal it. I showed it to you so that you could, you know, appreciate maybe that there are other countries that, you know, have really good music. Maybe help you gain inspiration, which is great, but don't forget to credit where it's coming from. And he said, well, I could do that because LMFAO, which is a popular, you know, they came out, I think, with the Shuffle back in when I was still in high school. They actually stole their music from Australia. So he said, oh, I could do the same thing. And I did get a little offended because that's not what we're trying to do here. We're not trying to give our what's coming out of our country a great product that should be enjoyed by all. We don't want to give that credit to someone else. The same thing happened when I went to Chicago. Again, it was the same situation. It was a Ukrainian event. I thought, why not throw in some Ukrainian music? And I went up to the DJs, who were all not Ukrainian. I showed them my playlist. They really liked it. And again, they joked about stealing it. And I said, please don't steal it. If you're not going to give credit, you have to think of something else. If you want to, you know, share it and, you know, get us on a bigger world stage, or, you know, share the great stuff that Ukraine is doing in the terms of music, then please be my guest. But don't forget to give credit. I think that's one of the biggest differentiating factors between appreciation and appropriation. Appropriation is more you're stealing it without giving credit and passing it off as your own, whereas appreciation is you're giving credit and you know where it's coming from and you've done the research and you appreciate where it comes from and its significance to other people. So the rest of the pre-chorus, I know we're still in the pre-chorus, goes, I'm like a bull in a china shop knocking off a knockoff because I got no culture, I got no culture of mine. A bull in a china shop is referring to a person who breaks things or often makes mistakes or causes damage in situations that require careful thinking or behavior. I believe that Ryan here is referring to white people stealing items and trends of strong significance in other cultures and using them to try and make a quick buck, depreciating the value of that culturally significant item and widespreading the knockoffs. One threat of globalization is the loss of authenticity, in my view. Knocking off has a double meaning here. Knocking the unauthentic china off shelves as a bull would, or repeating the cycle by imitating something that wasn't authentic to begin with, deepening the cycle of appropriation and whitewashing. Again, I believe that this further speaks to the fundamental human need for culture. If this need was not there, Westerners would not be so fascinated by other cultures and would not try to steal it for themselves without fully understanding the meaning that culture has to its indigenous people. People with strong cultures do not look elsewhere for other cultures. Personally, growing up, while it was interesting to learn about the Indian or Chinese culture during multicultural days in elementary school, I never felt the need to associate myself with them or to try and make them my own more correctly. I think it is also important to note that while these simple members of society, as I call them, you know, no culture people, I think that they are looking to fill that cultural void. They don't always look to other cultures. I believe that this cultural void is also where extreme xenophobia stems from. If you do not grow up with a strong culture, you begin to create one with what you know. Have you ever thought about what exactly is Canadian or American culture? The only thing that comes to my mind are cowboys and lumberjacks. These are professions and not significant cultural items or roles. So when people grow up with no strong cultural ties to where they are from, I believe they will fabricate them with the people that look like them and who grew up like them, cultureless. Now, this community with no culture is their culture, and they begin to bind themselves so strongly to that that they end up being afraid and hating those from other communities who do not look like them or who did not grow up like them. So welcome back. Again, for those of you that are just joining us, we are looking at Mother Mother's No Culture. And again, I think it's a song centered around identity crisis. So we've gotten to the chorus, and the chorus goes, so can we let sleeping dogs lie? Because everyone believes me when I say it's mine. A little wool over the eyes, because everyone believes me. Can we let sleeping dogs lie? Means to leave things as they are, especially to avoid restarting or rekindling an old argument, to leave disagreements in the past, or ignore a problem because trying to deal with it could cause an even more dire situation. A little wool over the eyes. To pull wool over someone's eyes is to deceive them in order to take advantage over them. Although Ryan is stating a well-known idiom here, it always reminds me of another idiom. Wolf in sheep's clothing, which I think is appropriate here as well. White people trying to understand and practice other cultures are sometimes seen as saviors and are credited with spreading the culture to a world stage. However, I think that this may not do more good than harm. I think it might not be as good as people think it is. Take Despacito for an example. That song was amazing. I mean, I loved it from the moment it came out. Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee, you know, they are huge music producers and artists in the Latin community. And they got recognition calls from Ricky Martin, Juan Luis Guerra, Marc Anthony, and other artists telling them that it was a home run before Justin Bieber got involved. Well, stealing may be the wrong word. I think that many people credit Justin Bieber to the widespread mania over the song. Here is a video of Justin Bieber mocking the Spanish language because he didn't actually know the words in Spanish. So that's just a little taste of what went down during that performance. It makes me so angry that people only began to take notice of this song because Justin Bieber remixed it and continue to credit him with this song. And to me, this video proves that he only did it to make a quick buck and, in my opinion, knocked off the original with one to cater to the American and later world audiences. One article states, Puerto Ricans Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee are already some of the most famous Latin stars in the world, while Justin Bieber's appearance in the remix lent the song the level of mainstream popularity only a true super famous global artist can bring. I've always been a fan of Latin music, and so I'm someone who will listen to it and will discover it and kind of look for new songs. It just kind of seems to me like it's a jumping on the bandwagon situation where people didn't really have an interest until it was Justin Bieber who was involved with it. Again, the chorus is where we see the true message of the song coming out. The narrator, acting as the white person stealing culture, is saying to leave him to do as he pleases because everyone believes that what he's doing is good and not bad. I think it is also insinuating the true power of whiteness. Everyone believes the white man over the oppressor and not the white man or the oppressor and not the colored people or the ones that are being oppressed. All right, welcome back. So again, those were two more songs off of Mother Mother's No Culture album, and No Culture is the song that we are looking at. So we have gotten to the second verse, which is the last non-repeating part of the song. The third verse goes, I want to love you, I want to make you mine. We make a child out of your culture, it got no culture. So I believe that this line is referring to mixed culture children who, if both parents aren't in agreement on which culture to raise their children in, the child will end up identifying with the not truly existing American, Canadian, white culture, or with an identity confusion and never truly knowing who they are. A girl writes, when I was little, I thought being mixed race was the coolest factor that defined who I was. And little me would proudly stand up and announce that each time we had a class introductions or shared fun facts at a summer camp. Once I was about 8 years old, a friend of mine came up to me during class one day and stated, "You're like the special Asian of our friend group." Not only did this statement confuse 8-year-old me, I found myself thinking, "I am one of you because I too am white. But am I really white? Am I really Asian? Where do I find myself on this race-to-race spectrum?" Race is one of the most defining socio-demographic characteristics of a person, so it makes sense that someone's identity can be molded based on what family they were born into. For a mixed-race person, race becomes even more confusing. Half of you is something, the other half is another thing. But that can sound a bit problematic, since that implies a mixed-race person isn't completely one thing or another. So the issue of belonging to a specific group arises, and so does a sense of confusion. I remember being called the white cousin among my Korean cousins. It also didn't help that I never learned Korean. Am I a bad Asian because of that? And feeling slightly like an outsider, even during family reunions. And then among my group of white friends, I was always the Asian one, which made me feel like I was further pushed into the fringes of the group. I was never white enough or Asian enough to be completely included. Racial imposter syndrome is actually something, if anyone has heard of imposter syndrome, I think it's usually referred to in the spectrum of being in a job or working in a field that you're not really 100% sure about, and you feel like you don't belong there, you feel like an imposter. So now we've heard this term, racial imposter syndrome. There was an NPR article, which I will read to you now. It was really interesting. It's tricky to nail down what makes someone feel like a racial imposter. For one Code Switch follower, it's the feeling she gets from whipping out broken but strangely colloquial Arabic in front of other Middle Easterners. For another, a white passing Native American woman, it's being treated like just another tourist when she shows up at powwows. And one woman described watching her white, black, and Korean American toddler bump along to the new Kendrick and wondering, is this allowed? In this week's podcast, so this was an NPR article about their podcast, they go deep into what they're calling racial imposter syndrome, the feeling, the science, in a giant festival that was happening that weekend in Los Angeles, which is all about this syndrome. A couple months ago, listener Christina Ogilvie wrote saying, living at the intersection of different identities and cultures was like stumbling around in a forest in the dark. She asked, do you hear from other listeners who feel like fakes? Good question. So they asked their audience. They got 127 emails from people who were stumbling through that dark, racially ambiguous forest. Here are some excerpts drawn from the many letters that they sent. Angie Yingst of Pennsylvania writes, my mother is a Panamanian immigrant and my father is a white guy from Pennsylvania. I've always felt liminal, like I drift between race and culture. When I was young, in my 20s and living in the city, I would get asked multiple times a day where I was from, where my people were from, because Allentown, Pennsylvania clearly wasn't the answer they were looking for. It always felt like the undercurrent of that question was, you aren't white, but you aren't black. What are you? But truthfully, I don't feel like I fit with Latinas either. My Spanish is atrocious, and I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. Even my cousin said a few weeks ago, well, you aren't really Spanish because your dad is white, which gutted me truly. I identify as Latina. I identify with my mother's culture and country as well as American culture. In shops, I'm treated like every other Latina, followed around and then ignored at the counter. I married a white guy and had children who are blonde and blue-eyed, and I'm frequently asked if I'm the nanny or the babysitter. And white acquaintances often say, you are white, you act white. And I saltily retort, why? Because I'm not doing your lawn or taking care of your kids? You need to broaden your idea of what Latina means. Jen Boggs of Hawaii also writes, she often feels like a racial imposter but isn't sure which race she's faking. I was born in the Philippines and moved to Hawaii when I was 3. I grew up thinking that I was half Filipina and half white, under the impression that my mom's first husband was my biological father. I embraced this hapahole identity, as they say in Hawaii, and loved my ethnic ambiguity. My mom wanted me to speak perfect English, so she never spoke anything but to me. After she divorced her first husband and remarried my stepdad from Michigan, my whiteness became cemented. Except, as it turns out, my biological father was a Filipino man whom I've never met. I didn't find out until I tried to apply for a passport in my late 20s, and the truth came out. So at age 28, I learned that I was not half white, but all Filipina. This is new knowledge was a huge blow to my identity, and admittedly to my self-esteem. But I'm white, I remember thinking. I am so, so white. After much therapy, I'm happy and comfortable in my brown skin, though I'm still working out how others perceive me as this other Asian person. Another user writes, her mom is Jamaican and her dad is African American. She wrote about the way people's perception of her changed based on where she lives. Culturally, we grew up as Jamaicans, as two California-born black American children could have in the Bay Area. We ate mostly Jamaican food prepared by both of our mother and father. Our Jamaican family lived with us growing up, and it was my mother that told us Anansi stories and other tales or sayings popular in Jamaica. Both my parents are black, so no one ever asked, "What are you?" But then when folks would meet my mom, they would say things like, "Oh, I thought you were black," or "You do look Jamaican." And I would tell people, "I'm still black," and clearly Jamaicans look like black Americans because we are both the descendants of enslaved West Africans. Now that I live in New York City, where if you're black, people assume you are first-generation Caribbean, I often have to remind people that my dad is black American, and so am I. Helen Seeley is originally from California. She told us what it's like for her to interact with different groups as a light-skinned biracial woman. White people like to believe I'm Caucasian like them. I think it makes their life less complicated, but I don't identify 100% as white. So there are always comes a time in the conversation or relationship where I need to out myself and tell them that I'm biracial. It's a vulnerable experience, but it becomes even harder when I'm with black Americans. It may sound strange, and there are so many layers to this that are hard to unpack, but I think what it comes down to is they have more of a claim to blackness than I ever will, and therefore have the power to tell me I don't belong, I'm not enough, that I should stay on the white side of this identity line. You know what question we always get asked, what are you? Well, I still don't know. I've never had an answer that I can say with confidence. I still don't know what I'm allowed to claim. Natalia Romero echoes those same feelings. Her family left Colombia for the U.S. when she was 9 years old, and she says that while she doesn't consider herself white, she gets treated like she's white all the time. My mother doesn't speak English, and so when I am home, all we speak is Spanish and act like a bunch of rowdy, tight-knit Colombians. I grew up experiencing what many poor young immigrants face: bad schools, hunger, poverty, a lack of resources, but eventually managed to pay my way through college and work now as a musician and teacher, often in very white communities. When people talk about the current political climate, they speak to me as if I were white, not someone who is terrified of the hatred of Latinx and Hispanic people, someone who walks around with my green card in my wallet knowing that until I am a citizen, which I morally have a huge problem with, I am not safe. I exist and inhabit these white spaces, but my experience is not white. My experience comes from being the sole English speaker at my house at age 9 and having to speak for my parents at the bank, at school, in apartments. My experience is from pretending my youngest sister wasn't part of our family because the apartment complex only allowed 4 people to a 1-bedroom apartment and we couldn't afford a 2-bedroom one. I come from a place where people speak poorly of Latinx people around me, not realizing that I am one. Everyone's story is different and is discussed on the podcast. They're still learning how to talk about identities that fall outside of our traditional understandings of race in the U.S. Luckily for those who are confused, you're in good company, is what the NPR article says. This is why I think that the melting pot is dangerous. As human beings, we struggle enough with identity crises and knowing who we are, what we stand for, and the values that guide our life. I believe that culture is such an important yet unexplored part of the human psyche, which once we understand better can help the West be more of a mosaic than a melting pot, as our PM Trudeau has stated. The melting pot is problematic unless both parents can agree on which culture to raise their children and they teach their child about who they are and why so that they are confident in their identities and can deal with the tornado of questions and perceptions that will inevitably be thrown at them. So that's everything that I have to say. I feel like it was a very opinionated today, but let's listen to No Culture one more time. All right, so thanks everyone for listening. That's it for today. If you have any suggestions for songs that I should look at in the future, I guess we're only here for another few weeks. Don't forget to tweet at Radio Laurier or send us a message on Instagram at Radio Laurier. And I hope that everyone has a nice start to their March.